You're listening to the Miscarriage Doula Podcast. I'm your host, Arden Cartrett. This space is meant to be a tool for you to feel less alone and to learn more about how to get through what you've been through and what you're probably going through. We'll hear diverse stories from women and men in the online space, experts and people just like you and me who are feeling the effects of miscarriage and loss in real time. This is the Miscarriage Doula Podcast. Shauna, thank you so much for being willing to come on the show and share your story. I am going to let you take over the mic and just start wherever your story begins.
Okay. Thanks, Arden. Thanks so much for having me. I wanted to first thank you for all that you do. And I'll get into this a little bit more, but your work is emotionally exhausting. And it also is a lifeline for so many of us who are in the thick of pregnancy loss, myself very much included. And I first wanted to start with the power of stories because I'm a lawyer and I work for a criminal justice reform organization. And our main tool is storytelling. And I think by storytelling, we humanize people, we humanize our experiences, we normalize complicated experiences in lives. As a lawyer, that's my job. And so being here today is really important to me because it's a chance to share my story. And I don't really think there's anything more beautiful or more powerful than sharing with people, even perfect strangers, so that, you know, the perfect stranger who stumbles on this podcast, maybe having just had a terrible doctor's appointment, might feel a little less alone hearing our stories. And a little less full of shame and fear and everything else that we all feel. So normalizing the experience of pregnancy loss in my mind and my experience is key to starting to heal. And then finally, storytelling is particularly important for pregnancy loss because for almost all of us, pregnancy loss is a loss of a dream. We don't have any tangible representation of our pregnancies. Sometimes I've even felt like are all of these experiences a fever dream that I'm living. And so telling the story is also part selfish because it makes it real. It makes what I experienced real. I was pregnant twice. I did experience great loss and trauma, and I'm still standing here today and able to tell my story, and that's helpful for me. So I'm going to dive into what happened to me with sort of the timeline and go into things. I had my IUD removed on November 30th of 2021, and I didn't get a period until January 8th. And I thought my period would come sooner, but it kind of took a few months for me to learn my body. I had an IUD in for 10 years, and I hadn't had a period at all. And in February, I tracked my ovulation, and I was really pleasantly surprised that my period and ovulation cycle was predictable. That was sort of felt like the first big hurdle that I could actually predict when things would happen. So 2 weeks after my February period, I was, you know, my ovulation predictor kit was positive. And now I was in, I was in the first week in March and I was about to go on a trip to Miami with my college friends. And I knew that I had ovulated. I knew that we were trying. My college friends and I hadn't been together in a really long time, and it was a few days before I was supposed to get my next period, but I figured I would take a pregnancy test so that I knew whether I could drink that weekend, basically. And I took the test the day before I left for Miami, and I left it on the counter, and I did a triple take because it was faintly positive, and I looked at it, and I remember looking at it and being like, am I seeing things? Is this like me willing it into a little tiny positive line? Unbeknownst to me, a faint line is a positive pregnancy test, especially because it was a few days before my period was expected. So that meant I was pregnant. But I didn't even tell my husband before I left for Miami because I was in my mind like, this can't be real. I want to test again when I actually have missed my period. But then I got to Miami and immediately told all my friends. I'm an open book and I didn't want to play the whole like, oh, I'll have a virgin margarita. And I also have been involved in women's health for a really long time as an advocate, as a lawyer. As one point, I was an aspiring midwife. So I know that loss is really common. And I told myself that, you know, I'll get ahead of anything bad by telling my friends early, like really early, so that they can be here for me if something goes wrong. And I sort of in my mind remember thinking, if I do this, maybe it will make it so that it's nothing goes wrong. If I try and prevent it, it will make sure that things are okay. So I actually told a handful of people, I didn't shout it from the rooftop or anything, but I told people who I would also want to know if something bad had happened. So fast forward a few weeks and I was 7.5 weeks pregnant and I really couldn't wait to tell my parents. I'm really close to my parents and this would have been their first grandchild. And so my husband, Caleb, and I convinced them to fly to Chicago, which is where we live, for the weekend. And they knew that we were thinking about having kids. And I guess my not so subtle demanding that they make a last minute trip gave us away. My mom really loves lottery tickets. And so when they got there, we handed them these fake lottery tickets that when you scratch off the box, it reveals a prize saying we're having a baby. And my parents were elated. I'm still kind of haunted by their joy and how, you know, I can see them kind of jumping up and down and my mom screaming, I knew it. I'm going to prove to you that I knew it. And she ran upstairs and got this pre-written card that she had wrote before she got to Chicago to show us that she knew. And we hung it on our fridge and I felt so good at giving my parents this joy. I am also a disaster planner. I have serious anxiety from early like childhood trauma. And so I always plan for worst case scenarios. I map them out. I visualize them. I try and sense them. So even that weekend, as my parents were basking in the glow of imagining their lives as new grandparents, I kept saying to them, you know, let's not get too excited. My first appointment's in 2 days. We'll know more then. But at the same time, I was doing body checks on myself. And I was like, okay, pain? No. Check. Blood? No. Check. Nausea? Yes. Check. That's a good thing. Hunger? Yes. Check. That's a good thing. So, you know, this sort of like assessment I was doing was helping calm my nervous system down. And I also thought that it might help me actually feel excited rather than, you know, excited about what could be rather than terrified about what could go wrong. But a few days later, Caleb and I got in the car to go to my first prenatal appointment. And it was April 4th, which was April 4th, 2022. And we got engaged on April 4th, 2019. So I told myself that, you know, nothing can go wrong. It's a good day for us. And we got to the appointment and I remember sort of the unbearable weight of waiting in the waiting room. And when we finally got back to the ultrasound room, I got on the table and squeezed Caleb's hand. And I, you know, it was an early pregnancy ultrasound. So it's a transvaginal ultrasound. And I didn't want to look at the screen at first. I was too nervous. But I didn't really need to because immediately we knew something was horribly wrong. The first thing that the tech asked me was whether I was in pain. And I said no, and she must have asked me 3 or 4 more times. And finally, my husband said, you know, he was getting angry with her. And he was like, she told you she's not in any pain. Can you please tell us what's happening? And the tech said, you know, there is a pregnancy and it's a healthy embryo. There's a steady, strong heartbeat. But the embryo has implanted in your right fallopian tube. It's an ectopic pregnancy. And I didn't believe her at first. I sort of like, I couldn't internalize her words. And as I sort of mentioned earlier, I've been involved in women's health for a long time and I know anatomy. So I know what a pregnancy looks like and I'm still haunted by the image of looking up at the ultrasound screen and seeing my uterus, which was, you know, thick with lining and completely empty. There was nothing in it. It was just thick with lining. And I laid on the table as she continued to take photos. And then before she turned off the machine, she asked me if I wanted to hear the heartbeat, and I freaked out. And I yelled and I told her, absolutely not. And I think I knew that I would never recover if I heard what was beating inside of me, because I knew that it would soon stop. And I was in shock and I couldn't really emote, which is really unusual for me because I'm such an emotional person and I'm, you know, I cry a lot. Crying is really like how I express myself sometimes. So from there, she said, you know, why don't you guys get dressed? I'm going to go check the waiting room. Basically, she was trying to make sure there wasn't like a pregnant person in the waiting room. And I'm going to walk you guys to the doctor's room. And she walked us to a room in the doctor's office that was filled with posters of butterflies and had no exam table. And when I saw that we were in an office room that had no exam table, I started to cry, because I think I then realized, you know, there was no exam necessary. We were just planning on what to do next. And Caleb and I were silent. And I looked down at my phone and saw texts from my mom and a few of my friends who knew that our appointment was that day. And texting my mom and telling her that the pregnancy was ectopic was one of the hardest things that I've ever done. I kept playing her joy in my head and then having to text her and say that it was, not only was it bad, but my life was at risk now. So it was, you know, for my mom, double bad. A few minutes later, the doctor came in and she sat with us and she had a really somber look on her face. And she, you know, confirmed the text diagnosis that the pregnancy was ectopic. And she told me the treatment options, but she said, you know, in your case, there's no option. Your embryo has a heartbeat and it's quite large. So you need to have surgery. We're scheduling it right now. And I looked at her and I said, you know, well, I can't do the surgery today because I have a business trip in DC tomorrow and I have to get on a plane early in the morning. And again, like I was in shock, right? So I didn't understand the gravity of the situation that I was in. And she reached her hands across the table towards me and she didn't touch me, but it was really kind of intimate and kind of her to reach her hands across the table. And she looked me square in the eyes and she said, honey, you are alive because you did not get on that airplane. You cannot go home to get a change of clothes, let alone travel. You are walking straight to the hospital from here. The hospital is across the street. She said, your embryo is taking up the entirety of your fallopian tube and I'm very concerned about it rupturing. You need surgery as soon as we can get an operating room available. So Caleb and I walked across the street to the women's hospital at Northwestern, which is called Prentice. And it's a very well-regarded hospital. We had to wait for a few hours. And then the surgeon came in and she was awful. I mean, as great as my doctor was, the surgeon was terrible. She ran through a litany of possible complications. She said to me and to Caleb, so we might need to take out your ovary. We may need to do a full hysterectomy. We may need to give you a colostomy bag. You may need a catheter for a while. We may need to cut out part of your colon. You know, we really just don't know what we'll get when we open you up, but you know, we'll do the best we can. Do you consent? And as a lawyer, I sat there and I knew what she was doing. I've read cases and law school, like I know what informed consent is. And I know she was trying to make sure that she got informed consent. But as a patient and as a woman who had just experienced one of the most traumatic moments in my life, I was completely taken aback by her absolute lack of compassion. And, you know, I had the surgery and the last thing that I remember before going into the operating room was my amazing doctor, who's not a surgeon, rushed over to the hospital at the end of her day so that she could be with me in the operating room and hold my hand as the anesthetics like took hold of my body. And that was the last thing I remember. About an hour later, the surgeon called my husband and she told him that it was the largest embryo she had ever seen in a fallopian tube that had not yet ruptured. And she sort of chuckled to him, like almost boasting her talents, and told him, you know, well, I saved your wife's ovary. And before she hung up, she said to him, you know, your wife's lucky to be alive. And so I think, you know, for couples experiencing this kind of loss, like, I don't know that she said that to him until he told me. And his experience of this day was made better after he knew that I was alive. It was awful to hear that from the doctor, but at the same time, he had been reckoning with, oh my God, you know, I might not just lose this pregnancy, I might lose my wife. And so as soon as he knew that I was okay, he, you know, sort of, he was starting to feel better, but I wasn't. And I was discharged from the hospital a few hours later, and my discharge papers were a complete mess. And again, this is from like a very well-regarded women's hospital. They had inconsistent directions on how to use opioids. They had a follow-up prenatal appointment on my schedule that I had scheduled when I was still pregnant that they didn't think to cancel or take off of my discharge papers. But most surprisingly, they had no guidance or information on grieving the loss of a pregnancy. So I was really left to figure that out on my own. And I, you know, I woke up that morning on April 4th, full of pregnancy symptoms. I went to bed April 4th with surgical wounds and then woke up the next morning with no symptoms at all. Overnight, it was like the weirdest thing. All of my pregnancy symptoms disappeared. And I think what was one of the most surprising things about all of this was that I had no pain. I had no pain from the ectopic. I had no pain after the surgery. You know, modern surgery is amazing. I had these incisions, but they were relatively small. My abdomen was swollen from like the gas that they fill you with, but nothing hurt. Like physically, I was fine, but I could barely get out of bed. And the recovery from this was almost entirely emotional. And the medical system just does not know how to treat the emotional side of what we go through. And it's also really hard for loved ones and friends to know how to treat the emotional side of pregnancy loss. In the days following the ectopic, my husband and my mom kept trying to sort of corral me to get up and try to do small activities or things just to feel alive, but I had zero interest in them. And I'm not really prone to depression, anxiety, yes, but depression, not so much. But that week was filled with the heaviest depression that I've ever experienced. And my mom kept calling me and I could hear the fear in her voice and her deep, like really deep sorrow. And she kept trying to tell me that everything would be okay. And she kept trying to make things, you know, find some like positive light in it. And finally, one day I just snapped and I told her that she was making it worse and that her like constant and consistent enthusiasm for trying to find something positive was making me just feel shame on top of everything else. And, you know, I remember telling her, I'm not okay. I know that I will be okay, but I don't know how long it will take me to feel okay. And I'm not there yet. And I'll never forget her, like, I could hear her silence. Like, she was silent on the phone. And she said, you know, ever since you were a little girl, all I've ever wanted to do is take away your pain. That's my job as your mother and as your protector. And for the first time, I feel like I can't do that. And I don't know what to do. And I felt like I could really relate to her in that moment. And I was so grateful for like her vulnerability of sharing that with me. And so I told her just to be there, just to listen. And she did. And much to her credit, you know, she really did that. And I want to share that because I think that grief is so, so desperately lonely. And it's so hard, not just for the person or the people who are experiencing it, but for the people who are also in your orbit, because people don't, we don't know like how to talk about grief or how to support someone through grief. And so I think like one of the biggest things that I've learned and that my family and my friends have learned is just to sit with people in their pain. Like don't try to take it away because you can't take it away. And don't try to tell them what it should feel like because you can't tell them what it will feel like. Definitely don't say any, at least, you know, statements like that, at least you're alive, which I got a lot. And at least, you know, you can get pregnant, which I also got a lot. I think the most that you can do for someone who's grieving is just to sit in silence and let them know that they're not alone. So the second week after my surgery, my anxiety started to kick in, and like my depression like faded a little bit, and then my anxiety started to come back. And my anxiety was, you know, it's all this productive energy. And so I wanted to find all of the resources that I could. I was sort of like, okay, if no one's going to find these resources for me, my doctors aren't going to help, I have to do it on my own. Fine. I can do that. I'll figure out how to pick myself back up. And I think at the time it felt genuine. I think I genuinely wanted, you know, I was desperate for connection, for finding things that would help sort of guide me on a path to recovery. But if I'm honest with myself, I think I probably convinced myself that if I worked really hard at leaning into my pain, I would heal more quickly and be able to start crying again sooner, which is not like the best thing to admit, but that's definitely, it was all geared towards wanting to just be able to move through it so that I could try. So I started doing therapy twice a week. I saw an acupuncturist. I was listening to podcasts. I read support group messages. I opened myself up to all of it. And as the weeks went by, I started to feel more. I went from being like completely numb to the world to being able to see color in the sky and hear noises outside. And I also sold myself on this narrative that felt comforting. You know, ectopic pregnancies are really, a lot of doctors will say this, that they're a freak accident. And so I told myself, well, an ectopic pregnancy is not a fertility problem. Like I don't have fertility issues. It's just shitty luck. And if anything, you know, I told myself I have some pretty good like fertility data points. You know, I got pregnant relatively quickly. Everyone kept saying, which was not great of them to say, but I guess it helped this narrative, that the embryo was really healthy. It just implanted in the wrong place. And that narrative and those data points carried me through and made me feel like, okay, this was just a blip in the radar. Once my body moves on, I'll be fine. But as most of us who have experienced pregnancy loss know, nothing is as planned. So on May 8th, which was Mother's Day, I got some light spotting, and it was like a little baby period. And I was thrilled because my doctor had told me that as soon as I got a period, I could start trying again. And she had said, you know, when you get a normal period, you can start trying. And I kind of ignored her like normal period and just said in my mind, I was like, oh, well, there's blood. It's a period. I can start trying. I was just really eager to keep swimming and keep moving forward and trying to sort of move on from what had happened. So 2 weeks later, my husband and I decided that we would start trying that month. I really don't think that I thought anything would happen. I just thought that it would be good to get in the mindset of trying again and trying to like help both of us sort of get back in that, like, you know, okay, if we're testing ovulation and we're waiting and, you know, the sort of like time period of trying. So 2 weeks later, after that, I started to feel things that I recognized from March. My breasts were sore and I had these intense hunger pains. But there was also something new. I had flashbacks. I had like really intense flashbacks, to what felt like months ago, but was really only about 6 weeks earlier. And every time I felt a tinge of excitement that I might be feeling early pregnancy symptoms, my mind then flashed to the ultrasound room and then to the operating room and then to the discharge room and then to the three scars on my abdomen. I was looking for signs to make me feel better, to make me feel like this one was going to be the one that stuck. And I hadn't actually tested myself yet. I just was feeling some symptoms. So a few days later, I got out of bed and the remaining stitch from my ectopic surgery had finally popped to the surface. And I felt like it was a good omen. And then I decided to take a pregnancy test. And sure enough, the test was positive. And my due date for this pregnancy would have been around the same time we conceived the last pregnancy. And the first day of my last period was Mother's Day, and a bird's nest had nested on the front stoop of our house that same day. And my grandma had sent me an email 2 days before saying, you know, be patient and good things will come your way. And I remember like collecting these things as if they were like comfort blankets that would help me feel like, you know, this pregnancy will be okay. And, you know, this last one, the ectopic, that was a blip, but this one would be the one that would give me a baby. As an anxious person who's also really type A, I genuinely believe that if I can just control all of the variables, the outcome, you know, I can direct the outcome and I'll be safe. And honestly, I have some good reason to believe that because I've been able to use that for most of my life. I've been able to set goals and swim really hard towards those goals and then achieve them. Anxiety is really productive energy, but you know, the kicker is that anxiety has no answer for what happens when life rears its unexpected head. And pregnancy loss is just, you can't control anything. So for the first few weeks of this second pregnancy, this was in early June of 2022, things seemed okay. I was pretty terrified, but my hormones looked healthy enough. And I had was doing the checks of like no bleeding, no pain. I went in for the first ultrasound appointment. And in my mind and in Caleb's mind, if the appointment ended in anything but an operating room, it was a success. And it was like, looking back at that, it was really sad. We literally like packed a bag for the emergency room. We brought snacks with us. We brought books. We brought phone chargers. I didn't eat anything that morning in case I had to go have surgery. Like we were, you know, I mean, it's trauma. But it was a success that day in the sense that, you know, I was around 5.5 weeks and the tech said that it appeared like there was a gestational sac in my uterus. And I looked up at that same screen in that same room where I had been, you know, 6 or 8 weeks earlier. And I saw this like little tiny floating circle in my uterus and I felt elated. I felt like all my hard work of really leaning into everything and trying to work through it had paid off. And like, this was what I was owed for having experienced the awfulness of the ectopic. And I felt validated that I didn't have a fertility issue. It was just a mechanical problem with that fallopian tube. So I talked to my doctor and she was like, you know, don't get too excited. She was cautiously optimistic, but you know, we'd know more the next week. So at 6 weeks, you can expect to see a fetal pole and maybe a heartbeat. And I made the appointment for 6.5 weeks to try and be sure that we would see those markers. But when we went in for the ultrasound, what we saw on the screen looked almost identical to what we had seen the week before. So there was no fetal pole, there was no heartbeat, and my doctor was out of town. So I felt like incredibly alone. And I knew that things were not looking good, but we had to wait for the blood work to see what my hormone levels were showing. So we drove home, and this was June 24th. And in the car on the way home, my phone blew up. With notifications, everyone was texting me and I couldn't figure out why. And then I saw that the Supreme Court had released their opinion in Dobbs, which overturned Roe versus Wade. So 2 hours after Dobbs was overturned, I learned from the doctor who called me that I would need an abortion to terminate the second non-viable pregnancy. And it felt like a sick joke. I felt like the universe was like, just throwing lightning bolts down at me. And everyone told me not to try and let the national news compound my personal news, but I don't know how I couldn't. Like, it, the personal was so political and the political was so personal. And it also, practically speaking, became immediately important for me that I lived in a state that protected my right to end my pregnancy. So then, you know, the next week I had to go back in for a final ultrasound to confirm that the pregnancy was not viable. And sure enough, you know, the ultrasound showed that same small floating screen, that floating circle that had pretty much been unchanged from 2 weeks before. And we were walked back to that same room filled with the butterfly posters waiting for the doctor. And I really love my doctor. I know so many people whose doctors spend 10 minutes, offer quick explanations, and leave them to sort of, you know, Google all the other answers. But my doctor is like amazing. And she knows that I'm a lawyer. And so sometimes we talk about reproductive rights work. And again, this was a few days after Roe had been overturned. And she walked into the office with misoprostol in her hand. And as she like handed it over to me, I saw her shaking. And she had said, you know, I can't stop thinking about your ectopic pregnancy. And tears started coming to her eyes. And I could see goosebumps on her arms. And she said, I can't bear to think about what would have happened to you if we had to treat your ectopic with misoprostol because you couldn't get an ultrasound because we couldn't risk you knowing that you were pregnant and us trying to figure out how to terminate it without anyone knowing. And so we just had to mail you the pills and hope for the best. And she, you know, paused and she looked at me and Caleb, who was there with me, and she said, you wouldn't be here if we had to do that. And it's so avoidable. And I just can't make sense of any of it. And the air was so heavy in that room. And I felt like both the luckiest person and the unluckiest person. I felt lucky to be alive and lucky to have a doctor who visibly like cared deeply about my life. Lucky to have a partner who was wading through the thick of all of this with me. Lucky to live in a state that honors my ability to participate as an equal member of society and trusts my ability to make my own decisions for my own life. And lucky to have family who would never guilt me or shame me for having two failed pregnancies. And at the same time, within the two different months, I had to terminate two different pregnancies. And I felt like no one was less lucky than me. I'm like, Arden, I'm happy to talk about misoprostol and the pill in a little bit, but I also just wanted to talk a little bit more about the reckoning of like compounded loss and compounded trauma. So as I said before, I've had anxiety most of my life, and to cope with trauma and loss, I meticulously plan for things on the front end with the anticipation that my planning will help keep me safe and will help get me to where I want to be. Anxiety is fuel. And so I want to keep going and going and moving. And then there are moments when I crash because all of the effort of engineering plans and pivoting and replanning and trying to spin out every situation is exhausting. And it feels like a slap in the face when the crutch that has taken me so far in my life is kicked out from under me. But pregnancy and fertility don't care about your perfect plans. It doesn't matter what I do or how hard I try. It's the one time in my life where I genuinely cannot control the outcome. And I feel depleted. I feel completely depleted. And this past weekend, actually, like all of this came crashing around me. I was healing from COVID, also still healing from the miscarriage from a month ago or 3 weeks ago. I had a friend cancel plans on me. I just felt alone. I felt disconnected from my community. And I felt like I've been working so hard to dictate the outcomes of my life, and my life has dictated the outcomes for me. And I was sitting in the living room crying to Caleb, and he said something that I just like, I can't shake. We live really close to Lake Michigan in Chicago. And anytime you go to the beach, there are these signs that say, if you get caught in a riptide, don't fight against the current, let it carry you. And there's this little diagram on the sign that shows how if you just surrender to the riptide, the tide eventually brings you back to shore where you can swim safely. So as we sat in our living room, my face was like swollen from sobbing. And Caleb had said, you know, those signs at the beach about riptides, the more you fight what's happening, the harder it will be. Because each time you feel like you've gotten over one wave, another wave inevitably comes and you just end up feeling angry and exhausted and like you should be done with the waves because you've put in the fight to get past one. And he said, but what if you stopped fighting the waves and just let them carry you for a little bit? And what if you just let go? And when he said this, I felt myself fighting it. And we had actually been at the beach a few weeks ago. And I remember looking at that sign and thinking to myself, why would I ever let the tide take me? You have to swim. You have to fight. You have to try and get to the next wave and get yourself back to shore. But I think when he said this to me, I had this realization that I've been equating letting go with giving up, because anxiety has made me think that if I'm not moving and constantly planning and trying to direct something, everything will crumble and fall apart. But everything has crumbled, and yet I'm still standing and I'm still here. I'm alive and my life looks so different than anything I could have imagined a few months ago. But I think that these experiences have made me think about the power of letting go. And again, like not giving up, but letting go. I would not have imagined this life for myself and I wouldn't wish it on anyone, but and I'm certainly not going to stand here and call this a silver lining, because there's nothing that I hate more than someone turning trauma into a silver lining. But what I will say is that I am recognizing my growth and I'm recognizing how these experiences are helping me grow. And, you know, people always say, you're so strong. Like that's what people say to people who go through pregnancy loss, right? But like, we don't have an option. You have to be strong. I wish I had an option, but I don't. But I can also take time to learn new depths of my strength. And I suppose that I can be proud of that. So I think that's where I'm at with everything right now.
I think that's really insightful and important. And I like that you made sure to mention that even though those are all aspects of your journey that you've quote unquote learned from, it's not a silver lining. Like you would absolutely yeah. love to learn these lessons in other ways, maybe from hearing other people's stories, unfortunately, but like it's a confusing place to be of like, I've learned this, but it's not a silver lining.
Totally. And maybe like, yeah, I mean, I think the problem with silver linings is that if you don't feel something from these experiences, it makes you feel like you've done something wrong. And none of us need more shame. We don't need someone to tell us how to feel. But I think if we can find, you know, I feel proud of being able to find some like growth in this.
Yeah. And I would love if you wouldn't mind sharing about your Cybertech experience, because
yeah,
you know, that's one that varies person to person, but I think you mentioned storytelling being so important, and with miscarriage, especially, everybody's experiences are the same, but they're different. And so mm-hmm. there's also education in sharing these things. So I know somebody listening will be able to relate to so many aspects of your story.
Sure. So you, Arden, were instrumental in helping me with the pill because you had sort of helped sketch out for me what it might be like. And for me, you know, expectations are key. And I, you know, in some ways, I think you've heard a lot of stories of bad experiences, and my experience is not bad at all. So learning from you, I went in with it thinking, you know, I went into it thinking it was going to be this like be awful. And basically, you know, the doctor gave me the misoprostol in the office. And then the next day I took the mifepristone, I forget how to pronounce it.
I also do not know how to pronounce it. And stumble on it. But I do want to point out that because you're in Chicago and we've talked a little bit about Roe, because you live in a state where access to both medications is not as illegal, I guess is the best word to say, that does make a big difference in side effect. And a lot of doctors aren't aware of that, or a lot of states don't allow it. Like, I know I live in North Carolina where Cytotec is legal, but the MIFA, can't say it either, is illegal. And so that's so interesting. But I think that that's a really key part of your Cytotec experience, because there are, there's a lot of data showing that they're successful with both medications.
Yeah. And another thing I didn't know is that not every doctor is able to prescribe or give out misoprostone. So that's the whatever it is, the first one you take, there's two pills. The first one you take is the MISA something. The second is the MIFA something. And not every doctor can give the MISA. That's like, you need a special prescription for that. So if you are in the position where you need the pill, I would try and find a doctor, you know, that can, that is legally able to prescribe you both pills. Even if you're in a state like Illinois, not every doctor can give you both pills. So I actually, my husband had trouble picking up the prescription from the pharmacy. They were like, why do you need this? Who is it for? And he said, you know, look, my wife is having a miscarriage and the doctor prescribed this. And they, I'm angry that they challenged him, but he was still able to get it and bring it home. So I put the four tablets. And I, that morning I woke up and I was like, I'm going to get coffee that I want, and I'm going to get a donut and kind of set the stage for myself so that I feel safe. I put towels on the bed, for the bleeding. I made sure I had the heating pads. And then I put the tablets in my mouth and put on some junk TV show. I don't even remember what it was, and just waited. And about an hour and a half later, I went to the bathroom and noticed blood starting to come out. And my bleeding was not super heavy. You had described to me that there's sort of this like pinnacle moment where you pass most of the content and then your body feels this like relief. And that was exactly what I had experienced. But what I think was really interesting was what the content of my uterine, of my uterus was so small. And I think that's part of also, that's also part of why my experience was better than other people's, because it confirmed what the doctor, I think, had nicely been trying to tell me, which was that there really hadn't been much growth. Yes, I was pregnant, but there was barely any development. And in some ways, like seeing that, like literally seeing it, made me feel better, because it made me feel like this is a big ball of cells. And it just looked like nothing. I mean, it didn't look like much. So once that passed, you do feel, it's very weird. You do feel this like wave of relief. And then I got back into bed and just had a heating pad on my uterus, like on my abdomen, the whole day, and made sure to drink a lot of water. I had taken like, I think 600 milligrams of ibuprofen in the morning, which helped a lot. And my bleeding slowed down after that sort of peak moment of passing what was inside. And then the rest of the day really just felt kind of like bad period cramps. My cramps lasted for, I think, 3 days. And the bleeding lasted for about 5 to 6 days, but it really tapered off after the first 3 days and was pretty light. And, you know, I think one of the like worst things is having to just see the blood, because my doctor told me I wasn't allowed to use a tampon or anything like that. So I had to just wear a pad for 6 days and see the blood every time I went to the bathroom. And it just sort of prolongs what you're going through. So again, for me, it was the emotional part of it rather than the physical part of it. And I was able also, because I live where I do, I was able to go back to my doctor 2 weeks later And she did another ultrasound to confirm that everything had cleared my system. So I didn't need any follow-up treatment. So it really was kind of, you know, sort of a, I don't want to say like neat and clean way, but it felt like, I think the good thing about the pill was that I felt like I had control over the timeline. I was able to like literally set my room in the way that I wanted it to be, and then could start to move on or move forward.
Yeah, I think your experience is really important to share. I actually have a highlight on Instagram where people shared their Cytotech experiences, and there were some quote unquote positive experiences. I always put that in positive because it sucks to call it a positive experience because it's still pretty terrible. But not everybody ends up in the ER. Not everybody ends up needing a DNC, and that is an important message to share because, you know, I always describe it as I wish we would just be given like best case scenario and worst case scenario. And with miscarriage, that's always so hard because even the best case scenario sucks.
But
we're always just kind of told by doctors that best case scenario. So if the worst case does happen, we were like, what the hell is happening to our body? Yeah. What do I do? And it just, it's all an unknown and scary place to be.
Yeah, it is for sure. And I think the one thing that I'll say about the pills too, just given like my experiences, I think if you are feeling symptoms of an ectopic pregnancy, like please talk to your doctor. You know, I mean, that was the scariest thing for me of what my doctor told me, which was that if I had the ectopic and took that, I likely would have ruptured and I would have died. So if you are feeling, you know, single-sided pain, shoulder pain, you have, I mean, bleeding, I guess you have with miscarriage anyway, but I mean, hopefully, you know, you can get an appointment with a doctor to make sure that it's not an ectopic pregnancy.
And if you cannot get an appointment with a doctor, go to the ER and demand an ultrasound.
Yeah. Yeah.
Literally demand it and tell them that you will not leave and you will hang out there and bleed out on the floor. Like as dramatic as it sounds, if you cannot get with your doctor, it's so important. Because like your doctor mentioned, it can be very deadly.
Yeah.
Especially in today's world, in most of the states here in the United States, it can be extremely, extremely deadly.
Yeah. And even though a lot of states say that they have exceptions for health and life of the mother, they don't define in the law what those are. And so that means that every decision has to go to an ethics board. And if you are about to have an ectopic pregnancy rupture, or you are miscarrying and you don't know whether it's an ectopic pregnancy or a, you know, sort of regular miscarriage, you could also die while someone is waiting to make a decision about whether your life is at risk. And it makes me, I'm sort of at like a loss for how angry it makes me, but it, you know, the sort of, they sell you on this, well, there's an exception for risk of the mother and life of the mother. And that's just not true.
Yeah. And it also depends on the physician that you're under the care of and their personal rights. I mean, their personal views and things like that as well, which is not helpful.
No, it is not.
Yeah. Well, Shauna, thank you so much for sharing your story. You shared it in such an eloquent way, and you have so many important messages that I know other people need to hear and will relate to. And I appreciate you coming on today and being so open. It's not an easy thing to do, but it's, you know, you didn't have a choice but to be strong, but you did have a choice to share your story. And I'm glad that you took that one.
Thank you. I appreciate you creating space for us to share our collective stories. I know that it is so important, and I really appreciate you.
Thanks so much.